I'll wait with you a little bit, if you don't mind.
Now, she decided on impulse. She would ask now. She'd been waiting for days for the right time. But when could a time possibly be right for something like this? At least they would be alone now, with no chance of disturbance.
As you like. I shall be glad of the company.
Not for long, she thought, as he turned away to rummage in the basket she had brought. She would much have preferred darkness. It would have been a lot easier to ask what she needed to know on the dark trail to the house. But words wouldn't be enough. She had to see his face. Her mouth was dry. She accepted gratefully when he offered her a cup of cider. It was strong and rich, and the slight buzz of alcohol seemed to lighten the weight in her belly a little. She gave him the cup, but didn't wait for him to drink, afraid that the momentary heartening effect of the cider would desert her before she could get the words out.
"Da?"
"Aye, lass."
He was pouring more cider, his eyes fixed on the cloudy golden stream.
"I need to ask you something."
"Mm-hmm."
She took a deep breath and got it out in a rush.
"Did you kill Jack Randall?"
He froze for a moment, the jug still tilted over the cup. Then he turned the jug carefully upright and set it down on the floor.
"And where will you have heard that name?" he asked.
He looked at her straight on, his voice as level as his eyes.
"From your father, maybe. From Frank Randall."
"Mother told me about him."
A muscle twitched near the corner of his mouth, the only outward indication of shock.
"Did she?"
It wasn't a question, but she answered it anyway.
"She told me what happened. What he did to you at Wentworth."
Her small spurt of courage was exhausted, but it didn't matter. She was in too deep to go back now. He simply sat and looked at her, the gourd cup forgotten in his hand. She longed to take it and drain it herself, but didn't dare. It occurred to her, much too late, that he might think it a betrayal that Claire had told anyone, let alone her. She rushed ahead, babbling in her nervousness.
"It wasn't now. It was before. I didn't know you. She thought I'd never meet you. I mean, I don't think. I know she didn't mean to."
He raised one eyebrow at her.
"Be still,
She was only too glad to stop talking. She couldn't look at him, but sat staring down at her lap, her fingers pleating the russet cloth of her skirt. The silence lengthened, broken only by the shiftings and muffled squeals of the piglets, and an occasional digestive rumbling from Magdalen. Why hadn't she found some other way, she wondered, in an agony of embarrassment.
"Thou shalt not uncover thy father's nakedness."
To invoke Jack Randall's name was to invoke the images of what he had done, and that wasn't something she could bear even to think about. She should have asked her mother, let Claire ask him. But no, there hadn't been any choice, not really. She had to find out from him. Her racing thoughts were interrupted by his words, calmly spoken.
"Why are you asking, lass?"
She jerked her head up to find him watching her over his undrunk cider. He didn't look upset, and the jelly in her backbone stiffened a little. She clenched her fists on her knees to steady herself, and met his eyes straight on.
"I need to know whether it will help. I want to kill him, the man who..."
She made a vague gesture at her belly and swallowed hard. "But if I do, and it doesn't help..." She couldn't go on. He didn't seem shocked, abstracted rather. He raised the cup to his mouth and took a sip slowly.
"Mm-hmm. And will you have killed a man before?"
He phrased it as a question, but she knew it wasn't. The muscle quivered near his mouth again, with amusement, she thought, not shock, and she felt a quick spurt of anger.
"You think I can't, don't you? I can. You'd better believe me, I can."
Her hands spread out, gripping her knees, broad and capable. She thought she could do it, though her image of how it might happen wavered. In cold blood, shooting seemed the best, perhaps the only certain way. But trying to imagine this, she had realized vividly the truth of the old saying, shooting's too good for him. It might be too good for Bonnet. It wouldn't be nearly good enough for her. In the night, when she flung off her blankets, unable to bear even this slight weight and its reminder of restraint, she didn't just want him dead. She wanted to kill him, purely and passionately. Kill him with her hands, taking back by the flesh what had been taken from her by that means. And yet, what good would it be to murder him if he would still haunt her? There was no way to know, unless her father could tell her. "Will you tell me?" she blurted. "Did you kill him, finally? And did it help?" He seemed to be thinking it over, his eyes travelling slowly over her, narrowed in assessment.
"And what would be helped by your doing murder?" he asked. "It will not take the child from your belly, or give you back your maidenhead."
"I know that." She felt her face flush hot and turned away, irritated both with him and herself. They spoke of rape and murder, and she was embarrassed to have him mention her lost virginity? She forced herself to look back at him. "Mama said you tried to kill Jack Randall in Paris, in a duel. What did you think you'd get back?" He rubbed his chin hard, then drew in his breath through his nose, and let it out slowly, eyes fixed on the stained rock of the ceiling.
"I meant to take back my manhood," he said softly. "My honour."
"You think my honour isn't worth taking back? Or do you figure it's the same thing as my maidenhead?" She mocked his accent nastily. Sharp blue eyes swung back to hers.
"Is it the same thing to you?"
"No, it is not," she said through clenched teeth.
"Good," he said shortly.
"Then answer me, damn it!" She struck a fist on the straw, finding no satisfaction in the soundless blow. "Did killing him give you back your honour? Did it help? Tell me the truth." She stopped, breathing heavily. She glared at him, and he met her eyes with a cold stare. Then he raised the cup abruptly to his mouth, swallowed the cider in one gulp, and set the cup down on the hay beside him.
"The truth? The truth is that I dinna ken whether I killed him or no."
Her mouth dropped open in surprise. "You don't know whether you killed him?"
"I said so."
A slight jerk of the shoulders betrayed his impatience. He stood up abruptly, as if unable to sit any longer.
"He died at Culloden, and I was there. I woke on the moor after the battle with Randall's corpse on top of me. I ken that much, and not much more."
He paused, as though thinking, then, mind made up, he thrust one knee forward, pulled up his kilt, and nodded downward.
"Luke."
It was an old scar, but no less impressive for its age. It ran up the inner side of his thigh, nearly a foot in length, its lower end starred and knotted like the head of a mace, the rest of it a cleaner line, though thick and twisted.
"A bayonet, I expect," he said, looking at it dispassionately.
He dropped the kilt, hiding the scar once more.
"I remember the feel of the blade striking bone, and no more. Not what came after, or before."
He took a deep, audible breath, and for the first time she realized that his apparent calmness was taking a good deal of effort to maintain.
"I thought it a blessing that I could not remember," he said at last.
He wasn't looking at her, but into the shadows at the end of the stable.
"There were gallant men who died there, men I loved well. If I didna know their deaths, if I couldna recall them or see them in my mind, then I didna have to think of them as dead. Maybe that was cowardice, maybe not. Perhaps I chose not to remember that day. Perhaps I cannot if I would."
He looked down at her, his eyes gone softer, but then turned away, played swinging, not waiting for an answer.
"Afterward? Aye, well. Vengeance didn't seem important then. There were 1,000 dead men on that field, and I thought I should be one of them in ours. Jack Randall?"
He made an odd, impatient gesture, brushing aside the thought of Jack Randall as he might a biting deer-fly.
He was one of them. I thought I could leave him to God. Then.
She took a deep breath, trying to keep her feelings under control. Curiosity and sympathy struggled with an overwhelming feeling of frustration.
You're all right, though. I mean, in spite of what he did to you.
He gave her a look of exasperation, understanding mingled with half-angry amusement.
Not many die of it, lass. Not me. And not you.
Not yet.
Involuntarily, she put a hand over her belly. She stared up at him.
I guess we'll see in 6 months if I die of it.
That rattled him. She could see it. He blew out his breath and scowled at her.
You'll do fine, he said curtly. You're wider through the hip than yon wee heifer.
Like your mother? Everybody says how much I'm like her. I guess she was wide through the hip too, but it didn't save her, did it?
He flinched, quick and sharp as though she'd slapped him across the face with a stinging nettle.
Perversely, seeing it filled her with panic rather than the satisfaction she'd expected.
She understood then that his promise of protection was in good part illusion. He would kill for her, yes, or willingly die himself, she had no doubt. He would, if she let him, avenge her honour, destroy her enemies. But he couldn't defend her from her own child. He was as powerless to save her from that threat as if she'd never found him.
I'll die, she said,
cold certainty filling her belly like frozen mercury. I know I will.
You won't.
He rounded on her fiercely, and she felt his hands bite into her upper arms.
I will not let you.
She would have given anything to believe him. Her lips were numb and stiff, rage giving way to a cold despair.
You can't help, she said. You can't do anything.
Your mother can, he said,
but sounded only half convinced. His grip slackened, and she wrenched herself free.
No, she can't.
Not without a hospital, without drugs and things. If it goes wrong, all she can do is to try to save the baby. Despite herself, her gaze flickered to his dirk, blade gleaming cold against the straw where he had left it. Her knees felt watery, and she sat down suddenly. He snatched up the jug and slopped cider into a cup, pushing it under her nose.
"Drink it," he said. "Drink up, lass. You're pale as my sark."
His hand was on the back of her head, urging her. She took a sip, but choked and drew back, waving him off. She drew a sleeve across her wet chin, wiping off the spilled cider.
"You know what's the worst?"
"You said it wasn't my fault, but it is."
"It is not."
She flapped a hand at him, bidding him be quiet.
"You talked about cowardice. You know what it is." "Well, I was a coward. I should have fought. I shouldn't have let him. But I was scared of him. If I'd been brave enough, this wouldn't have happened, but I wasn't. I was scared. And now I'm even more scared," she said, voice breaking.
She took a deep breath to steady herself, bracing her hands on the straw.
"You can't help, and neither can Mama. And I can't do anything either. And Roger..."
Her voice did crack then, and she bit her lip hard, forcing back tears.
"Brianna, Eliana..."
He made a move to comfort her, but she drew back, arms folded tight across her stomach.
"I keep thinking... if I kill him, that's something I can do. It's the only thing I can do. If I have to die, at least I'll take him with me. And if I don't, then maybe I can forget, if he's dead."
"You will not forget."
The words were blunt and uncompromising as a blow to the stomach. He was still holding the cup of cider. Now he tilted back his head and drank, quite deliberately.
"It does no matter, though," he said,
setting down the cup with an air of businesslike finality.
"We shall find you a husband, and once the babe's born, you will not have much time to fret."
What? She gaped at him. What do you mean, find me a husband?
You'll need one, eh?
He said, in tones of mild surprise.
The bairn must have a father. And if you will not tell me the name of the man who's given you a swollen belly, so that I might make him do his duty by you.
You think I'd marry the man who did this?
Her voice cracked again, this time with astonishment. His voice sharpened slightly.
Well, I'm thinking, have you maybe playing with the truth a bit, lass? Perhaps it wasn't a rape at all. Perhaps it was that you took a mislike to the man and ran. I made up the story later. You were not marked, after all. Hard to think a man could force a lass of your size if you were unwilling altogether.
You think I'm lying?
He raised one brow in cynicism. Furious, she swung a hand at him, but he caught her by the wrist.
Ah, no, he said reprovingly. You're no the first lass to make a slip and try to hide it, but...
He caught the other wrist as she struck at him, then pulled them both up sharply.
You didn't need to make such a fuss, he said. Or is it that you wanted the man, and he threw you over? Is that it?
She swiveled in his grip, used her weight to swing aside, brought her knee up hard. He turned only slightly, and her knee collided with his thigh, not the vulnerable flesh between his legs she had been aiming for.
The blow must have bruised him, but didn't lessen his grip on her wrists in the least. She twisted, kicking, cursing her skirts. She hit his shin dead on at least twice, but he only chuckled, as though finding her struggles funny. Is that all you can do, lassie?
He broke his grip then, but only to shift both her wrists to one hand. The other prodded her playfully in the ribs.
There was a man in the Muir of Skene. He had dirks, and I had nain. But I fell on him with my thumbs, and what ye how, I dirk at him, dirk at him, dirk at him.
With each repetition he dug a thumb hard between her ribs.
You fucking bastard, she screamed.
She braced her feet and yanked down on his arm as hard as she could, bringing it into biting range. She lunged at his wrist, but before she could sink her teeth into his flesh, she found herself jerked off her feet and whirled through the air. She ended hard on her knees, one arm twisted up behind her back so tightly that her shoulder joint cracked. The strain on her elbow hurt. She writhed, trying to turn into the hold but couldn't budge. An arm like an iron bar clamped across her shoulders, forcing her head down, and farther down. Her chin drove into her chest. She couldn't breathe. And still he forced her head down. Her knees slid apart, her thighs forced wide by the downward pressure.
Stop, she grunted.
It hurt to force sound through her constricted windpipe.
God's sake, stop.
The relentless pressure paused, but didn't ease. She could feel him there behind her, an inexorable, inexplicable force. She reached back with her free hand, groping for something to claw, something to hit or bend. But there was nothing.
I could break your neck, he said,
very quietly. The weight of his arm left her shoulders, though the twisted arm still held her bent forward, hair loose and tumbled, nearly touching the floor. A hand settled on her neck. She could feel thumb and index fingers on either side pressing lightly on her arteries. He squeezed, and black spots danced before her eyes.
I could kill you, Sue.
The hand left her neck and touched her, deliberately, knee and shoulder, cheek and chin, emphasizing her helplessness. She jerked her head away, not letting him touch the wetness, not wanting him to feel her tears of rage. Then the hand pressed sudden and brutal on the small of her back. She made a small, choked sound and arched her back to keep her arm from breaking, thrusting out her hips backward, legs spread to keep her balance.
I could use ye as I would, he said,
and there was a coldness in his voice.
Could ye stop me, Brianna?
She felt as though she would suffocate with rage and shame.
Answer me.
The hand took her by the neck again and squeezed.
No.
She was free. So suddenly released, she pitched forward onto her face, barely getting one hand down in time to save herself. She lay on the straw, panting and sobbing. There was a loud waffle near her head, Magdalen, roused by the noise, leaning out of her stall to investigate. Slowly, painfully, she raised herself to a sitting position. He was standing over her, arms folded.
"Damn you!" she gasped.
She slammed a hand down in the hay.
"God, I want to kill you!"
He stood quite still, looking down at her.
"Aye," he said quietly. "But you can't, can you?"
She stared up at him, not understanding. His eyes were intent on hers, not angry, not mocking, waiting.
"You can't," he repeated, with emphasis.
And then realization came, flooding down her aching arms to her bruised fists.
"Oh, God," she said. "No, I can't. I couldn't. Even if I'd fought him, I couldn't."
Quite suddenly she began to cry, the knots inside her slipping loose, the weight shifting, lifting, as a blessed relief spread through her body. It hadn't been her fault. If she had fought with all her strength, as she had fought just now.
"Couldn't," she said,
and swallowed hard, gasping for air.
"I couldn't have stopped him. I kept thinking, if only I'd fought harder. But it wouldn't have mattered. I couldn't have stopped him."
A hand touched her face, big and very gentle.
"You're a fine braw lassie," he whispered, "but a lassie nonetheless. Would you fret your heart out and think yourself a coward because you couldn't have fight off a lion with your bare hands? It's the same. Dinna be daft now."
She wiped the back of her hand under her nose and sniffed deeply. He put a hand under her elbow and helped her up, his strength no longer either threat or mockery, but unutterable comfort. Her knees stung where she had scraped them on the ground. Her legs wobbled, but she made it to the hay pile, where he let her sit down.
"You could have just told me, you know," she said, "that it wasn't my fault."
He smiled faintly.
"I did. You couldn't have believed me, though, unless you knew for yourself."
"No, I guess not."
A profound but peaceful weariness had settled on her like a blanket. This time she had no urge to tear it off. She watched, feeling too limp to move as he wetted a cloth from the trough and wiped her face, straightened her twisted skirts, and poured out a drink for her. When he handed her the freshly filled cup of cider, though, she laid a hand on his arm. Bone and muscle were solid, warm under her hand.
"You could have fought back, but you didn't."
He laid a big hand over hers, squeezed, and let it go.
"No, I didn't fight," he said quietly. "I gave my word for your mother's life."
His eyes met hers squarely, neither ice nor sapphire now, but clear as water.
"I didn't regret it."
He took her by the shoulders and eased her down onto the piled hay.
"Do you rest a bit, Eliana?"
She lay down, but reached up to touch him as he knelt by her.
"Is it true that I won't forget?"
He paused for a moment, hand on her hair.
"Aye, that's true," he said softly. "But it's true, too, that it will not matter after a time."
"Won't it?"
She was too tired even to wonder what he might mean by this. She felt almost weightless, strangely remote, as though she no longer inhabited her troublesome body.
"Even if I'm not strong enough to kill him?"
A clear, cold draught from the open door cut through the warm fog of smoke, making all the animals stir. The brindled cow shifted her weight in sudden irritation and let out a low-throated "wah," not of distress so much as of querulous complaint. She felt her father glance at the cow before turning back to her.
"You're a very strong woman, Avyanach," he said at last, very softly.
"I'm not strong. You just proved I'm not."
His hand on her shoulder stopped her.
"That's not what I mean.
He stopped, thinking, his hand smoothing her hair over and over.
"She was 10 when our mother died, Jenny was," he said at last. "It was the day after the funeral when I came into the kitchen and found her kneeling on a stool, to be tall enough to stir the bowl on the table. She was wearing my mother's apron," he said softly, "folded up under the arms, and the strings wrapped twice about her waist. I could see she'd been weeping, like I had, for her face was all stained and her eyes red. But she just went on stirring, staring down into the bowl, and she said to me, 'Go and wash, Jimmy. I'll have supper for you and Dad directly.'"
His eyes closed altogether, and he swallowed once. Then he opened them and looked down at her again.
"Aye, I ken fine how strong women are," he said quietly. "And you're strong enough for what must be done, Mansach. Believe me."
He stood up then and went to the cow. It had risen to its feet and was moving restlessly in a small circle, swaying and shuffling on its tether. He caught it by the tether rope, gentled it with hands and words, made his way behind the heifer, frowning in concentration. She saw him turn his head and look to check his dirk, then turn back, murmuring. Not a loving butcher, no. A surgeon in his way, like her mother. From this odd plateau of remoteness, she could see how much her parents, so wildly different in temperament and manner, were alike in this one respect, that odd ability to mingle compassion with sheer ruthlessness. But they were different even in that, she thought. Claire could hold life and death together in her hands and yet preserve herself, hold aloof. A doctor must go on living, for the sake of her patients, if not for her own sake. Jamie would be ruthless toward himself as much as, or more than, he would be to anyone else. He had thrown off his plaid. Now he unfastened his shirt, with no haste, but neither with any wasted motion. He pulled the pale linen over his head and laid it neatly aside, returning to his watching post at the heifer's tail, ready to assist. A long ripple ran down the cow's rounded side, and the torchlight glimmered white on the tiny knot of a scar over his heart. Uncover his nakedness. He would strip himself to the bone if he thought it necessary. And, a much less comforting thought, if he thought it necessary, he would do the same to her without a moment's hesitation. He had a hand at the base of the cow's tail, speaking to it in Gaelic, soothing, encouraging. She felt as though she could almost grasp the sense of his words, but not quite. All might be well, or it might not. But whatever happened, Jamie Fraser would be there, fighting. It was a comfort. Jamie paused by the upper fence of the cowpen, on the rise above the house. It was late, and he was more than tired, but his mind kept him wakeful. The carving completed, he had carried Brianna down to the cabin, she sleeping sound as a babe in his arms, and then gone out again to seek relief in the solitude of the night. His shins ached where she had kicked him, and there were deep bruises on his thighs. She was amazingly powerful for a woman. None of that troubled him in the least. In fact, he felt an odd and unexpected pride in this evidence of her strength.
"She'll be all right," he thought. "Surely she will."
There was more hope than confidence behind this thought. Yet it was on his own account that he was wakeful, and he felt at once troubled and foolish at the knowledge. He had thought himself thoroughly healed, old hurts so far behind him that they could safely be dismissed from mind. He had been wrong about that, and it unsettled him to find just how close to the surface the buried memories lay. If he were to find rest tonight, they would have to be exhumed, the ghosts raised in order to lay them. Well, he had told the lass it took strength. He stopped, gripping the fence. The rustle of night sounds faded slowly from his mind as he waited, listening for the voice. He hadn't heard it for years, had thought never to hear it again. But he had already heard its echo once tonight, seen the blaze of anger's phantom in his daughter's eyes, and felt its flames singe his own heart. Better to call it forth and face it boldly than let it lie in ambush. If he couldn't face his own demons, he couldn't conquer hers. He touched a bruise on his thigh, finding an odd comfort in the soreness.
"No one dies of it," he'd said. "Not you, not me."
The voice didn't come at first. For a moment he hoped it wouldn't. Perhaps it had been long enough. But then it was there again, whispering in his ear as though it had never left. Its insinuations a caress that burned his memory as once they had burned his skin.
"Gently at first," it breathed, "softly. Tender as though you were my infant son. Gently. But for so long you will forget there was a time I did not own your body."
The night stood still around him, paused as time had paused so long before, poised on the edge of a gulf of dread, waiting. Waiting for the next words, known beforehand and expected, but nonetheless.
"And then," the voice said, loving, "then I'll hurt you very badly. And you will thank me and ask for more."
He stood quite still, face turned upward to the stars, fought back the surge of fury as it murmured in his ear, the pulse of memory in his blood, then made himself surrender, let it come. He trembled with remembered helplessness and clenched his teeth in rage, but stared unblinking at the brightness of heaven overhead, invoking the names of the stars as the words of a prayer, abandoning himself to the vastness overhead as he sought to lose himself below. Betelgeuse, Sirius, Orion, Antares. "The sky is very large and you are very small." Let the words wash through him, the voice and its memories pass over him, shivering his skin like the touch of a ghost vanishing into darkness. "The Pleiades, Cassiopeia, Taurus. Heaven is wide and you are very small. Dead, but nonetheless powerful for being dead." He spread his hands wide, gripping the fence. Those were powerful too. Enough to beat a man to death, enough to choke out a life. But even death was not enough to loose the bands of rage. With great effort, he let go, turned his hands palm upward in a gesture of surrender. He reached beyond the stars, searching. The words formed themselves quietly in his mind, by habit, so quietly he was not aware of them until he found them echoed in a whisper on his lips.
"Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us."
He breathed slowly, deeply, seeking, struggling, struggling to let go.
"Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil."
Waited, in emptiness, in faith. And then grace came, the necessary vision, the memory of Jack Randall's face in Edinburgh, stricken to bare bone by the knowledge of his brother's death. And he felt once more the gift of pity, calm in its descent as the landing of a dove. He closed his eyes, feeling the wounds bleed clean again as the succubus drew its claws from his heart. He sighed and turned his hands over, the rough wood of the fence comforting and solid under his palms. The demon was gone. He had been a man, Jack Randall, nothing more. And in the recognition of that common, frail humanity, all power of past fear and pain vanished like smoke. His shoulders slumped, relieved of their burden.
"Go in peace,"
he whispered, to the dead man and himself.
"You are forgiven."
The night sounds had returned. The cry of a hunting cat rose sharp on the air, and rotting leaves crunched soft underfoot as he made his way back toward the house. The oiled hide that covered the window glowed golden in the dark, with the flame of the candle he had left burning in the hope of Claire's return, his sanctuary. He thought that he should perhaps have told Brianna all this too. No, she couldn't understand what he had told her. He had had to show her instead. How to tell her in words, then, what he had learned himself by pain and grace? that only by forgiveness could she forget, and that forgiveness wasn't a single act, but a matter of constant practice. Perhaps she would find such grace herself. Perhaps this unknown Roger Wakefield could be her sanctuary as Claire had been his. He found his natural jealousy of the man dissolved in a passionate wish that Wakefield could indeed give her what he himself could not. Pray God he would come soon. Pray God he would prove a decent man. In the meantime, there were other matters to be dealt with. He walked slowly down the hill, oblivious to the wind that blew the kilt about his knees and billowed through his shirt and plaid. Things must be done here. Winter was coming, and he couldn't leave his women here alone with only Ian to hunt for them and defend them. He couldn't leave to search for Wakefield. But if Wakefield didn't come, well, there were other ways he would see Brianna and the child protected, one way or another. And at least his daughter was safe from the man who had harmed her. Permanently safe. He rubbed a hand across his face, smelling blood still on his skin from the carving.
"Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." "Yes, but what of those who trespass against the ones we love?" He couldn't forgive on another's behalf, and would not if he could. But if not, how should he expect forgiveness in return?
Educated in the universities of Paris, confidant of kings and friend to philosophers, still he was a Highlander born to blood and honour, the body of a warrior and the mind of a gentleman, and the soul of a barbarian, he thought wryly, to whom neither gods nor mortal law stood more sacred than the ties of blood. Yes, there was forgiveness. She must find a way to forgive the man, for her own sake. But he was a different matter.
"Vengeance is mine, seeth the Lord."
He whispered it to himself. Then he looked up, away from the safe small glow of hearth and home, to the flaming glory of the stars above.
"The hell it is," he said, aloud, shamed, but defiant. It was ungrateful, he knew, and wrong forby. But there it was, and no use to lie either to God or to himself about it. "The hell it is," he repeated louder, "and if I'm damned for what I've done, then let it be. She is my daughter."
He stood still for a moment, looking up, but there was no answer from the stars. He nodded once, as though in reply, and went on down the hill, the wind cold behind him. Chapter 49. Choices. November 1769. I opened Daniel Rawling's box and stared at the rows of bottles filled with the soft greens and browns of powdered root and leaf, the clear gold of distillations. There was nothing among the bottles to help. Very slowly I lifted the covering that lay over the top compartment, over the blades. I lifted out the scalpel with the curved edge, tasting cold metal in the back of my throat. It was a beautiful tool, sharp and sturdy, well-balanced, part of my hand when I chose it to be. I balanced it on the end of my finger, letting it tilt gently back and forth. I set it down and picked up the long, thick root that lay on the table. Part of the stem was still attached, the remnants of leaves hanging limp and yellow. Only one. I had searched the woods for nearly 2 weeks, but it was so late in the year that the leaves of the smaller herbs had yellowed and fallen. It was impossible to recognize plants that were no more than brown sticks. I had found this one in a sheltered spot, a few of the distinctive fruits still clinging to its stalk. Blue cohosh, I was sure, but only one. It wasn't enough. I had none of the European herbs, no hellebore, no wormwood. I could perhaps get wormwood, though, with some difficulty. It was used to flavour absinthe. "And who makes absinthe in the backwoods of North Carolina?" I said aloud, picking up the scalpel again.
"No one that I know of."
I jumped, and the blade jabbed deep into the side of my thumb. Blood spattered across the tabletop, and I snatched the corner of my apron, wadding the cloth hard against the wound in reflex.
"Christ, Sassenach, are you all right? I didn't mean to startle you."
It didn't hurt a great deal yet, but the shock of sudden injury made me bite my lower lip. Looking worried, Jamie took my wrist and lifted the edge of the wadded cloth. Blood promptly welled from the cut and ran down my hand, and he clamped the cloth back in place, squeezing tight.
"It's all right, just a cut. Where did you come from? I thought you were up at the still."
I felt surprisingly shaky, perhaps from the shock.
"I was. The mash isn't ready for distilling yet. You're bleeding like a pig, Sassenach. Are you sure you're all right?"
I was bleeding badly. Beside the splashes of blood across the table, the corner of my apron was soaked with dark red.
"Yes."
"I probably severed a tiny vein. It's not an artery, though. It will stop. Hold my hand up, will you?" I fumbled one-handed with the strings of my apron, seeking to free it. Jamie undid it with a quick yank, wrapped the apron round my hand, and held the whole clumsy bundle up over my head.
"What were you doing with your wee knife?" he asked, eyeing the dropped scalpel where it lay alongside the twisted cohosh root.
"I was going to slice up that root," I said, waving weakly at it. He gave me a sharp look, glanced across to the sideboard where my paring knife lay in plain sight, then looked back at me with raised brows.
"Aye? I've never seen you use one of these."
He nodded at the open array of scalpels and surgical blades.
"Save on people."
My hand twitched slightly in his, and he tightened his grip on my thumb, squeezing hard enough to make me catch my breath in pain. He loosened his grip, then looked intently into my face, frowning.
"What in heaven's name are you about, Sassenach? You look as though I'd surprised you about to commit murder."
My lips felt stiff and bloodless. I pulled my thumb out of his grasp and sat down, holding the wounded digit against my bosom with my other hand.
"I was deciding," I said, with great reluctance.
It was no good to lie. He would have to know sooner or later. "If Bree..."
"Deciding what?"
"About Bree. What was the best way to do it?"
"To do it?"
His eyebrows shot up. He glanced at the open medicine case, then at the scalpel, and a look of sudden shocked comprehension washed over his face.
"You mean to..."
"If she wants me to." I touched the knife, its small blade stained with my own blood. "There are herbs, or this. There are awful risks to using herbs. Convulsions, brain damage, hemorrhage. But it doesn't matter. I don't have enough of the right kind."
"Claire, have you done it before?"
I looked up to see him looking down at me with something I had never seen in his eyes before. Horror. I pressed my hands flat on the table to stop them trembling. I didn't do as well with my voice. "Would it make a difference to you if I had?" He stared at me for a moment, then eased himself down on the bench opposite, slowly, as though afraid he might break something.
"You haven't done it," he said softly. "I knew it."
"No," I said. I stared down at his hand, covering mine. "No, I haven't." I could feel the tension go out of his hand. It relaxed, curling over mine, enfolding it. But my own lay limp in his grasp.
"I knew you couldn't do murder," he said.
"I could. I have." I didn't look up at him, but spoke to the tabletop. "I killed a man, a patient in my care. I told you about Graham Mingus." He was silent for a moment, but held on to my hand, squeezing slightly.
"I think it isn't the same," he said at last, "to ease a doomed man to a death he wishes. It seems to me that that is mercy, not murder. And duty too, perhaps."
"Duty?"
That did make me look at him, startled. The look of shock had faded from his eyes, though he was still solemn.
"Do you not recall Falkirk Hill, and the night Rupert died in the chapel there?"
I nodded. It wasn't something easily forgotten. The cold dark of the tiny church, the eerie sounds of pipes and battle far outside. Inside, the black air thick with the sweat of frightened men, and Rupert dying slowly on the floor at my feet, choking on his blood. He had asked Dougal Mackenzie, as his friend and his chief, to hasten him. And Dougal had.
"It will be a doctor's duty too, I think," Jamie said gently. "If you are sworn to heal but cannot, and to save men pain, and can."
"Yes." I took a deep breath and curled my hand around the scalpel. "I am sworn, and by more than a doctor's oath. Jamie, she's my daughter. I would rather do anything in the world but this. Anything." I looked up at him and blinked, holding back tears. "Don't you think I haven't thought about it? That I don't know what the risks are? Jamie, I could kill her." I pulled the cloth off my wounded thumb. The cut was still oozing. "Look, it shouldn't bleed like that. It's a deep cut, but not a bad one. But it does. I hit a vein. I could do the same to Bree and never know it until she began to bleed. And if so, Jamie, I couldn't stop it. She'd bleed to death under my hand, and there isn't a thing I could do about it. Not a thing." He looked at me, eyes dark with shock.
"How could you think of doing such a thing, knowing that?"
His voice was soft with disbelief. I drew a deep, trembling breath and felt despair wash over me. There was no way to make him understand. No way. "Because I know other things," I said at last, very softly, not looking at him. "I know what it is to bear a child. I know what it is to have your body and your mind and your soul taken from you and changed without your will. I know what it is to be ripped out of the place you thought was yours, to have choice taken from you. I know what it is, do you hear me? And it isn't something anyone should do without being willing." I looked up at him, and my fist clenched hard on my wounded thumb. "And you, for God's sake, you know what I don't, what it's like to live with the knowledge of violation. Do you mean to tell me that if I could have cut that from you after Wentworth, that you wouldn't have had me do it, no matter what the risks? Jamie, that may be a rapist's child."
"Aye, I know,"
he began, and had to stop, too choked to finish.
"I know,"
he began again, and his jaw muscles bulged as he forced the words.
"But I know the one thing else. If I dinna ken his father, I ken his grandsire well enough. Claire, that is a child of my blood."
"Your blood?"
I echoed.
I stared at him, the truth dawning on me. "You want a grandchild badly enough to sacrifice your daughter?"
"Sacrifice? It isn't me that's meaning to commit slaughter in cold blood."
"You didn't mind the angel makers at the Hôpital des Anges? You had pity for the women they helped, you said so."
"Those women had no choice."
Too agitated to sit, he got up and paced restlessly back and forth in front of me.
"They had no one to protect them, no way to feed a child. What else could they do, poor creatures? But it isn't so for Brianna. I will never let her be hungry or cold, never let aught harm her, or the bear neither."
"That isn't all there is to it." He stared at me, brows drawn down in stubborn incomprehension. "If she bears a child here, she won't leave," I said unsteadily. "She can't. Not without tearing herself apart."
"So you mean to tear her apart?"
I flinched, as though he'd struck me.
"You want her to stay," I said, striking back. "You don't care that she has a life somewhere else, that she wants to go back. If she'll stay, and better yet, if she'll give you a grandchild, then you bloody don't care what it does to her, do you?"
It was his turn to flinch, but he turned on me squarely.
"Aye, I care. That doesn't mean I think it right for you to force her into..."
"What do you mean, force her?"
The blood was burning hot in my cheeks.
"For God's sake, you think I want to do this? No! But by God, she'll have the choice if she wants it."
I had to press my hands together to stop them shaking. The apron had fallen to the floor, stained with blood, reminding me much too vividly of operating theatres and battlefields, and of the terrible limits of my own skill. I could feel his eyes on me, narrowed and burning. I knew that he was as torn in the matter as I was. He did indeed care desperately for Bree. But now I had spoken the truth, we both recognized it. Deprived of his own children, living for so long as an exile, there was nothing he wanted more in life than a child of his blood. But he couldn't stop me, and he knew it. He wasn't used to feeling helpless, and he didn't like it. He turned abruptly and went to the sideboard where he stood, fists resting on top of it. I had never felt so desolate, so in need of his understanding. Did he not realize how horrible the prospect was for me as well as him? Worse, because it was my hand that must do the damage. I came up behind him and laid a hand on his back. He stood unmoving, and I stroked him lightly, taking some comfort from the simple fact of his presence, of the solid strength of him. Jimmy. My thumb left a slight smear of red on the linen of his shirt. It will be all right. I'm sure it will. I was talking to convince myself as much as him. He didn't move, and I ventured to put my arm around his waist, laying my cheek against the curve of his back. I wanted him to turn and take me in his arms, to assure me that it would indeed somehow be all right, or at the least, that he wouldn't blame me for whatever happened. He moved abruptly, dislodging my hand.
"You've a high opinion of your power, have you, Nu?"
He spoke coldly, turning to face me. "What do you mean by that?" He grasped my wrist in one hand, pinning it to the wall above my head. I could feel the tickle of blood down my wrist, flowing from my wounded thumb. His fingers wrapped around my hand, squeezing tight.
"You think it's yours alone to see? That life and death is yours?"
I could feel the small bones of my hand grind together, and I stiffened, trying to pull free. "It's not mine to say. But if she says, then yes, it's my power. And yes, I'll use it. Just like you would. Like you have, when you've had to." I shut my eyes, fighting down fear. "You wouldn't hurt me. Surely." It occurred to me with a small shock that he could indeed stop me. If he broke my hand. Very slowly, he bent his head and rested his forehead against mine.
"Look at me, Claire," he said, very quietly.
Slowly, I opened my eyes and looked. His eyes were no more than an inch away. I could see the tiny gold flecks near the center of his iris, the black ring surrounding it. My fingers in his were slippery with blood. He let go of my hand and touched my breast lightly, cupping it for a moment.
"Please,"
he whispered, and then was gone. I stood quite still against the wall, and then slowly slid to the floor in a bloom of skirts, the cut on my thumb throbbing with my heartbeat. I was so shaken by the quarrel with Jamie that I couldn't settle to anything. At last I put on my cloak and went out, walking up the ridge. I avoided the path that led across the ridge toward Fergus's cabin, and down toward the road. I didn't want to risk meeting anyone at all. It was cold and cloudy, with a light rain sputtering intermittently among the leaf-bare branches. The air was heavy with cold moisture. Let the temperature drop a few degrees more and it would snow. If not tonight, tomorrow, or next week. Within a month at the most, the ridge would be cut off from the lowlands. Ought I to take Brianna to Cross Creek? Whether she decided to bear the child or not, might she be safer there? I shuffled through layers of wet yellow leaves. No, my impulse was to think that civilization must offer some advantage, but not in this case. There was nothing Cross Creek could offer that would truly be of help in case of any obstetrical emergency. In fact, she might well be in active danger from the medical practitioners of the time. No, whatever she decided, she was better off here, with me. I wrapped my arms about myself under my cloak and flexed my fingers, trying to work some warmth and suppleness into them, to feel some sense of surety and touch. "Please," he'd said.
"Please what? Please don't ask her. Please don't do it if she asks." But I had to.
"I swear by Apollo the physician, not to cut for the stone, nor to procure abortion."
Well, and Hippocrates was neither a surgeon, a woman, nor a mother. As I'd told Jamie, I'd sworn by something a lot older than Apollo the physician, and that oath was in blood. I'd never done an abortion, though I had had some experience as a resident in the post-care of miscarriage. On the rare occasions a patient had asked it of me, I had referred them to a colleague. I had no absolute objection. I had seen too many women killed in body or spirit by untimely children. If it was killing, and it was, then I thought it not murder, but a justifiable homicide undertaken in desperate self-defense. At the same time, I couldn't bring myself to do it. The surgeon's sense that gave me knowledge of the flesh under my hands gave me also an acute awareness for the living contents of the womb. I could touch a pregnant woman's belly and feel in my fingertips the second beating heart, could trace, unseeing, the curve of limb and head and the snake-like curl of the umbilicus with its rush of blood, all red and blue. I couldn't bring myself to destroy it. Not until now, when it was a matter of killing my own flesh and blood. How? It would have to be surgical. Dr. Rawlings had evidently not done such procedures. He had no uterine spoon for scraping the womb, nor any of the slender rods for dilation of the cervix. I could manage, though. One of the ivory knitting needles, its point blunted. The scalpel bent to a shallow curve, its deadly edge sanded down for the delicate, but no less deadly, job of scraping. When? Now. She was already 3 months gone. If it was to be done, it must be as soon as possible. Neither could I bear to be in the same room with Jamie while the matter was unresolved, feeling his anguish added to my own. Brianna had taken Lizzie to Fergus's house. Lizzie was to stay and help Masali, who had her hands full with the distillery, little Germain, and the farm work that Fergus couldn't manage single-handed. It was a terrible load for an 18-year-old girl to be carrying, but she managed, with tenacity and style. Lizzie could at least help with the household chores, and mind the little fiend long enough to let his mother rest now and then. Brianna would come back before supper time. Ian was away, hunting with Rollo. Jamie, without being told, I knew that Jamie wouldn't be back for some time. We would have a little while alone. Would it be a suitable moment to ask her such a question, though, fresh from seeing Germaine's cherubic face? Though, on reflection, exposure to a 2-year-old boy was probably the best possible object lesson in the dangers of motherhood, I thought wryly. Vaguely lightened by the faint whiff of humour, I turned back, drawing my cloak around me against the increasing wind. As I came down the hill, I saw Brianna's horse in the penfold. She was home. My stomach clenched in dread. I went to lay the choice before her. "I thought of it," she said with a deep breath, "as soon as I realized. I wondered if you could do something like that here."
"It wouldn't be easy. It would be dangerous, and it would hurt. I don't even have any laudanum, only whiskey. But yes, I can do it, if you want me to."
I forced myself to sit still, watching her pace slowly back and forth before the hearth, hands folded behind her in thought.
"It would have to be surgical," I said, unable to keep quiet. "And I don't have the right herbs, and they aren't always reliable in any case. At least surgery is certain."
I laid the scalpel on the table. She shouldn't be under any illusions as to what I was suggesting. She nodded at my words, but didn't stop her pacing. Like Jamie, she always thought better while moving. A trickle of sweat ran down my back, and I shivered. The fire was warm enough, but my fingers were still cold as ice. Christ, If she wanted it, would I even be able to do it? My hands had begun to tremble with the strength.